The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Following another major leak from an offshore law firm, tax avoidance is back on the political agenda. This week, The Guardian revealed Her Majesty the Queen's private estate has millions invested offshore. We saw surreal footage of Tory donor Lord Ashcroft hiding in a party conference toilet to avoid questions on his offshore wealth, and the complex details of how multinationals such as Apple shop around for the lowest offshore tax rates. We'll hear what governments could do in response. Meanwhile, Theresa May staggers through another scandal-filled week as the list of her cabinet ministers in hot water grows. As mistakes and misdemeanours mount up, can she keep the show on the road?
When we ask people, who do you want to be the next leader, the winner tends to be none of the above.
But first, a massive new leak of documents shows that tax avoidance by the rich and famous is happening on an industrial scale. So much so that for those in a certain bracket, tax appears to be basically optional. The trove of documents leaked from law firm Appleby stretches to more than 13 million pages, and untangling them all were more than 300 journalists working across news organisations all over the world. And we have two of them here now, Juliet Garside and Hilary Osborne, and alongside them, the Observer's economics editor Philip Inman, and on the line, Nicholas Shackson, author of Treasure Islands, one of the best recent books on offshore finance. Now, Juliet, tell us a little bit more about how this story came about and what you uncovered. What's it like being in the room with those 13 million documents?
Well, we just published the Panama Papers last April, and we were sitting down having a little lunch, celebration lunch, with Gerard Ryle at the ICIJ, who told us at that point there'd been another leak.
Great news.
So we've known this was coming for, well over a year. Started working on it in December. Hilary came on board at that point, and we've been locked in a room on the fourth floor at The Guardian for the best part of a year.
I hear it's a bit fetid in there.
It's been hoovered twice. My desk hasn't been cleaned in the entire 10 months.
The cleaners aren't allowed in.
So, yes, it's got some of that caution tape over the door now.
And we should stress, we're not accusing anyone of acting illegally, are we? Stashing money offshore in a highly complex chains of trusts, companies and accounts is all perfectly legal. But what kinds of structures did you start to uncover?
Well, we came across jet leasing structures used by jet owners to import their planes into Europe without having to pay any import tax on them. So they set up a pretend business where they lease the jet from themselves. The only customer of the business is the owner of the business, who's the owner of the jet. So that's quite fun.
Including Lewis Hamilton was one of the more high-profile names.
Yes, Lewis Hamilton was in there. A lot of Russian oligarchs seems to be very popular with them. So there's schemes like that which appear to be abusive, according to the experts. And then you've got slightly more plain vanilla things, just people with large amounts of capital looking for places to invest it and ending up, rather than in some nice EZBT shares, in big offshore funds of hedge funds like the Queen, which Hilary looked at.
Yeah, tell us about Her Majesty's tax affairs, Hilary.
So, yes, there is no tax advantage to her for being offshore. But as Juliet said, she's gone into sort of a fairly aggressive fund. The particular one that I was looking at was the one that ended up owning part of Bright House.
And this is sort of rent to buy retailer, isn't it? That's not known for treating low-income customers well, shall we say.
It's like the Wonga of the high street, really. It's and she's ended up in there through a private equity fund. And I think that was the thing that surprised me most, really. There's no tax advantage to being offshore, but it seems a very aggressive way to invest. And you would sort of expect there to be a lot more due diligence maybe on where her money's gone.
And Hilary, the latest name in the frame is Prince Charles, isn't it? What's he's been up to?
Well, that's right. So we found that he's had a couple of offshore investments in the past. One was in a Bermuda company that invested in rainforests. And that's possibly the most controversial, because he's obviously talked quite a lot about rainforests. And this company was standing to make money from carbon trading if the sort of policies were extended and rainforests were allowed into that. And during the time he had the holdings, that was something that he sort of spoke out about and said that should happen. And so it does raise questions about whether he should have maybe declared his financial interest at the time he was talking.
Yeah, that's the worry, Phil, isn't it? That you know, these sorts of investments can create conflicts of interest for people who've got public platforms.
Absolutely. And obviously with our monarchy, how do you keep a tight rein on them when they are invested heavily through their assets, you know, whether it's their pensions or all their other assets around the world? You know, maybe they should be more circumspect, or maybe they should know more about the possible conflicts that they have.
And Nick, we've been talking about these kinds of things for a long time, haven't we? And successive governments have said, we're closing this loophole, we're closing that loophole. Is it as easy to do this kind of thing as it always was?
I think it's getting a little bit more difficult, just because so many eyes are on the problem. And also there are certain initiatives coming on stream now, international global initiatives to try and close some of these loopholes. There is one thing I'd like to say, though, that has been annoying me about this, and that is that a lot of the media coverage goes on about, you know, and I've had questions from the BBC and others saying, oh, well, it's all legal. I take exception to that, because a lot of this stuff, it is indeterminate. You don't know whether it's legal or not until there's been a court case, because a lot of this stuff involves very aggressive positions taken, cooked up by accountants and law firms, and they do it on the basis of risk. You know, what's the chances if this was challenged that it would be knocked down in the court of law? So, you know, suggesting that it's all legal, I think, is the wrong approach. I think, you know, tax avoidance is a problematic word for that reason, because it does, by definition, mean this stuff is not illegal. But in fact, that, you know, that is not correct. I think a lot of it is indeterminate. And I think other terms such as tax escape, tax cheating, tax dodging are more appropriate in these cases.
We did see in the documents the sort of caution by some of the accountants suggesting some of these schemes and saying HMRC might challenge this, or if you do that could be problematic. So I think that's absolutely right. I mean, some of it is legal, well, legal in quotes, because it hasn't been challenged.
Right. Right. And one of the questions, Julia, is about the whole industry that you get that's built up in order to try and create these kinds of structures, right? I mean, if they're incredibly creative, they're somewhat artificial. We're talking about advisors here, aren't we?
We're talking about the facilitators, the accountants, the lawyers, the tax experts, and the companies that will provide you with pretend directors and pretend shareholders for your shell company. So Appleby was doing a bit of both, the law and the nominees. And you see sort of smaller outfits that perhaps are a little more questionable, like the accountant who was advising Mrs. Brown's boys.
Gentleman that called himself the tax alchemist.
The tax alchemist. And then you see the big four accountancy firms, a lot of material in there from Deloitte. Ernst & Young was deeply involved in advising on jet leasing schemes in the Isle of Man. Deloitte was helping Blackstone avoid enormous amounts of tax in very aggressive ways on property in London and Glasgow.
So, Phil, is this just something that's always gone on and will always go on? I mean, as Juliet says, it's not just, you know, little firms on the edge that are doing this. It's the mainstream, the big accountancy firms.
It's the big accountancy firms, and I think if you look more broadly, everyone's at it. So if you look in Japan or Italy, nobody in Japan wants to pay tax. So they make the government borrow money and they lend the money to the government. And that money then gets channeled around the world in search of good investment opportunities. And most people are not really paying attention, like the Queen, whether that money goes into dodgy practices or companies that you wouldn't necessarily want to be investing in, because there are so many layers between you as an investor and where that money actually ends up. Quite often you don't know and you don't care. Most of our pensions are invested in a lot of these sorts of things. And that search for yield, this term, the search for yield, that a lot of economists will use, is a kind of global phenomena. You know, if you can't make money working, you make money investing, and so a lot of that money is deployed what we might think of as in a rather dubious way. You know, when the subprime crash happened in 2008, that was in America, that was about selling homes to poor people in America they couldn't afford. But who were some of the major investors? They were like German doctors and others who had put their money into these schemes to go and invest in subprime property in America. You know, you could trace that money back to quite ordinary middle class people who want to secure their future. And so you think that actually there's a lot of people below the super rich who are obviously involved in much more sophisticated schemes, just as Juliet says, and Nicholas says, that that are dubious and could be challenged in court. You know, to some extent, a lot of people with some assets, and they don't have to be very many, are standing behind that and investing as well. So when you start to call a halt to it, you know, that's a big economic issue.
Nick, is that right? That sounded almost like a sort of shrug of despair, a kind of everybody's at it. We're all looking for returns somehow. You know, it's not surprising that these things end up happening. What can governments do? How can we change the culture in which this seems to be acceptable?
Well, I think that analysis, I totally agree with it. And I don't think it needs to be a shrug of despair. I think I think people need to understand the offshore system as a central component of financial globalization and global, you know, the freeing of global financial flows. I think in the past, people used to see it as a kind of exotic sideshow with a few kind of rogues and criminals and celebrities doing dodgy stuff. But a lot of this stuff, if you look at what happens in a lot of the tax havens, and you're looking at private equity firms, hedge funds, you're looking at special purpose vehicles, a lot of this stuff has financial stability implications. This is way beyond tax. This is a much bigger, deeper problem that we're dealing with. And I think what we are seeing is a kind of sea change in many democracies, particularly in the West, about the tolerance for this kind of thing. I think we are in a slow process of change as populations are waking up to the fact that really something has to be done. So I think, you know, while the scale of what needs to be done is absolutely gigantic, I think we are also seeing some secular political changes. I think, you know, the rising popularity of Jeremy Corbyn is a symptom of this. I think these secular political changes do have the potential to challenge the whole edifice of what has been growing up over the last 30 or 40 years. So I think there are serious grounds for hope, but it is also a terrifying
and Juliet
thing
and
that's going on.
You know, you're down in the sort of details of it, looking at the individual cases. What would it, does it feel as though something quite radical would have to be done? I mean, these schemes keep being set up and then they, as you say, they get found out and they get shut down and then something else pops up somewhere else. How can you stop this? It would have to be something quite radical, wouldn't it?
I mean, some of it is resources. I mean, as we've said, some of these things do...
For HMRC,
probably,
for example.
Yeah. So some of these things probably do cross the line, but the kind of... The amount of human power that we've put into this over the last year with all the other journalists, you would need that. You need that scale of attention to it to find those cases.
And the lawyers and the prosecutors and the time, yeah.
There's no silver bullet, but what people argue is transparency. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. Those are David Cameron's words. What he wanted to do, which he never quite managed because he called a referendum, you know, that was the end of that, was to try and make the tax havens associated with the UK, both here, like close to home, like Channel Islands, and further away, like the BVI and Caymans, produce public registers, like we do here in the UK, of who owns what company, the real owner, not the pretend nominee owner. So if the information is made public, it, you can ensure that, one, it's more accurate because there are lots of eyes on it, and two, you can check what people are doing. It's not going to solve everything, but it's the clearest, easy step that the government could take right now. May has declined to do so, but perhaps she'll change her mind.
And Phil, sometimes the response from government is, oh, well, we're not really in charge of the overseas territories directly. You know, we sort of cooperate with them, but we can't force them to do anything. That's a simple thing, though, isn't it, that the government could do is insist on these registers of beneficial ownership.
Yes. I mean, so far, we've just got, as Juliet said, where the tax man can go after people on those islands. But of course, they have to know what they're looking for.
They can request information, can't they, as I understand it?
They can, yes. And that information is now there, but you don't know what information they hold. So in effect, then you're accused of going on a fishing exercise if you say, right, well, we want to know everybody who is doing X or Y. the islands want to know specifics before they'll release the information. So you're then caught in this catch-22. So, of course, transparency would be much better. Having an open register would be play a large part in disinfecting this particular issue. I think that when you look at those islands and what they've been up to, there are people out there with pensions from the Isle of Man, perfectly legal, but tax-free, because if you keep it there for more than 7 years and you do it through one of these special vehicles, you can receive a pension and there's no tax to pay on it. And that's perfectly ordinary people who are being persuaded by their financial advisor to go through these routes. You know, there's so much money now is just being kept offshore, whether it's ordinary people with a few assets or the super rich, that I think the government has to take a broader view. And I think we will hear stuff from the Chancellor in the budget. I think, you know, obviously
it's coming up in a couple of weeks, isn't
well,
it?
Well, as Nicholas says, you know, that is the issue at hand. The government are cognizant of that. They realise that this is something that people want to hear is being done. They don't want the super rich running away with all the cash.
I mean, I think the British government in particular, which is, you know, Britain is responsible for a very large part of the whole global offshore system. The British government has played a game of smoke and mirrors for decades about the overseas territories, British overseas territories and crown dependencies, which include some of the biggest tax havens in the world. They do like to say there's nothing we can do because these places are kind of independent from us. And, you know, and these places do have a certain political independence. But at the end of the day, Britain can step in and simply strike down the legislation. Britain does have that power. These places depend completely on Britain's tolerance of what they're doing. So if the political will is found, Britain can absolutely transform what's going on. They say they can't. They like to say they can't because they like all this money coming into the City of London. But if they really want to, they can.
And do you think that political argument, part of this is about the politics, and do you think that political argument that Jeremy Corbyn made at the CBI earlier this week, that actually, you know, people should have to apologise if they're not paying their fair share, you know, that people have a sort of, you know, it's a civic duty to pay their taxes. Do you think that argument has more grip than perhaps it might have done 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely noticed a whole sea change in attitudes towards this. This is something that, you know, when I first started looking into tax havens many years ago, it was a minority sport. People didn't really pay too much attention to it. And now, you know, when I come to the UK, there are people in pubs, in, you know, supermarket queues talking about tax dodgers. And that is a real, you know, that is a real sea change. And I think so people are ready for very different attitudes towards this stuff. And, you know, long may it continue.
We haven't talked about multinationals, have we? Apple was on the list. You know, it's one thing to call out individuals for their behaviour and say they're not paying their fair share. But in some cases, we're talking about vast multinationals, aren't we?
Yeah. And Simon Bowers, who was used to be at The Guardian, has gone to the ICIJ, did an excellent piece of work on Apple, discovered that very soon after learning they were going to have to restructure in Ireland, lawyers for Apple sent out letters to Appleby and other firms, essentially jurisdiction shopping, saying if we would set up some shell companies in your manner, how would they be taxed? Would we have to hold board meetings there? And
so it's quite
the
latest.
Most startling question was, if there was like a general election, is there a credible opposition that might want to change things?
Might want to tax us?
They asked that question of the Isle of Man and Appleby replied, no.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it? And that's when you start to get into whether governments are powerful enough to do anything about this, isn't it?
It is a question of the will as well, that there seems to be this kind of feeling in some countries that they'd rather have a small part of a big sum of money from one of these companies than actually sort of get together with everyone else and make sure that the full amount of tax is being paid somewhere. I mean, I think you're right, that the names, the individuals are sort of more eye-catching names generally, but it's obviously the corporates that are shifting billions rather than millions, and we're all losing out as a result of that.
Well, even the Trump administration are taking that view that they'd rather have a small part of a larger pie. So they're going to reduce their tax rate from 35% to 20% on corporations. And that's as a desperate kind of move to try and get Apple to repatriate some of that money so they can tax some of it, at least some of it. And obviously, I can't remember what the figure is. Is it $3 trillion that's kept offshore by American corporations?
Something I think 2.6 trillion, yes.
Is it 2.6? Thanks, yeah. Thanks, Nicholas. So, you know, that for them is an enormous amount of money that they could bring back. And it shows the weakness of even the United States, you know, that they have to take that attitude.
But also that's European money. That's money they made in Europe.
Because the business has been done here. Yeah.
So what we need is a way of taxing companies according to where they make the most money.
And Britain is one of those, isn't it? Because we are the fastest adopters of a lot of Google, Amazon, all those sorts of things, much bigger than France, Germany, Italy. And so a huge amount of that money's actually been made here.
Nicholas?
But just one thing about that US repatriation, you know, cutting tax rates to bring all the money whooshing home. They tried that a few years ago. They had a special tax rate of 5.25%. And what American companies did was they put it all into, you know, executive bonuses and stock options. They had promised to create a lot of jobs. In the end, the companies that benefited most cut a lot of jobs. And then they started lobbying for the next tax amnesty. So they chuck as much as they can offshore, and then knowing that they're going to get another tax amnesty later. So this, you know, these kinds of things are counterproductive. They are not helping the United States. It is just a giant giveaway that is going to benefit a very small number of people in the United States and hurt a lot of taxpayers.
And so ultimately, it has to be about trying to find a way of taxing economic activity where it takes place, does it? Trying to tax the sales and the turnover where they take place, where the iPads are bought or whatever it is.
Yes, I think some very fundamental philosophical changes to the international tax system need to be made. But another point, a lot of people seem to think that to try and tax this stuff, you need to have international global cooperative mechanisms to, you know, prevent a race to the bottom. And while these things are helpful, I think at the end of the day, countries can unilaterally increase effective tax rates on wealthy individuals and on multinationals. And that will not damage their own economy. They can do it from a pure position of national self-interest without necessarily having to engage in cooperative international schemes. And what that will tend to do is it will tend to chase, you know, some of the flighty money, the hot money that isn't embedded in your economy will be chased away by that stuff. But the good stuff that you need, the investment with, you know, factories and jobs and local supply chains and stuff, that's not going to be scared away by tax. And you will get a lot more tax revenue from large multinationals. And, you know, your country will benefit, even if it acts unilaterally, in increasing the effective tax rates on multinationals.
And the problem is that the people in the Treasury just don't believe that. So they
Indeed.
Don't believe.
Indeed.
They're nervous. And they, you know, however sympathetic they might be to Nicholas's argument, they still think that Britain, as an old empire economy that has basically traded in money for a very long time, once you start to chase that money away, you start to undermine the fabric of the British economy. And that's really, really dangerous. And they think it's too big a risk to try a lot of what Nicholas is proposing.
Well, I think they're worried about also undermining the fabric of the British establishment, because that is what this is all about. And they hide behind this word competitiveness. They use this, they throw this word competitiveness out there. We must be competitive, must have a competitive tax system, competitive financial regulation. But this, once you start unpacking this word, I'm actually in the process of writing another book that unpacks this in great detail. The whole thing falls apart in kind of confusion and disarray. And, you know, this stuff basically doesn't work if you consider your population as a whole. You know, basically competitiveness involves throwing goodies at multinationals and at big banks in the hope that, you know, for fear they're going to run off to Geneva or Hong Kong. But it's a strategy that hasn't worked for Britain. It's brought us global financial crisis and rising inequality and all this, and hasn't really done anything for proper investment in the country.
But it's fair to say, Phil, isn't it, that governments are likely to be more anxious about trying to take radical action on some of these things at a time when we have Brexit looming, and they're particularly nervous about what happens to inward investment and so on.
Oh, all bets are off with Brexit. You know, there is really nothing is going to happen over the next 18 months. There's such a panic about what Brexit means. I mean, I think when you look at the forecasts, there's a kind of central forecast for what is going to happen with Brexit. And if you talk to people in the Treasury, they think it's there's a 99% certainty that that central forecast is wrong, because it'll either be much better or much worse than the central forecast says. And because either we will come out of this and all the doomsayers who say that cutting off our links with Europe is going to be terrible for the British economy, it turns out to be not as bad as we thought, or the opposite. So, and that's probably true. So it's probably likely that, but while that uncertainty exists, no Chancellor is going to, while he may have some initiatives, and I'm sure he'll say that on Budget Day in a couple of weeks, there's not going to be that philosophical readdressing of what it is to tax and what do you tax and how do you tax it that Nicholas is talking about.
Although I think it is the right time to be talking about tax, because I think that the kind of Brexit is going to have a lot to do with the way that we tax people and the way we behave towards other economies in terms of not trying to steal their tax bases. So if we have agreements with Europe about accessing market, customs, etc., we agree to apply European measures to try and, for example, blacklist tax havens or have more transparency around trusts and offshore companies and take a cooperative stance, then we aren't going to turn into even more of a massive tax haven than we already are. But, you know, we've heard Hammond make that threat, and we've heard Corbyn say, if we have the wrong kind of Brexit, if we have a hard Brexit, we're going to end up as a Singapore on the shores of Europe. And I think that's very much what's at stake here. And when you look at the people who profit from offshore, who have business offshore, and who also have political ties, who are donors, members of parliament, peers, they tend to fall into the hard Brexit camp.
Well, stamping down on tax avoidance has been a major theme of Jeremy Corbyn's policy platform, and the shadow cabinet was quick out of the blocks this week. I sat down with the shadow Treasury Minister, Jonathan Reynolds. Jonathan, you were just saying you've been looking at some of the stories that came out of the Paradise Papers leak, and even I think MPs have been talking to some of the journalists who were involved in digging through the files today.
That's right, an extraordinary job they've done in the public interest too. I mean, spending a year looking through 13.5 million documents, there's a real public service there. There's something to praise around, you know, the journalists still prepared to do that and news organisations willing to devote that kind of time to it. But the thing that really comes across to me is the industrial scale of tax avoidance. We're not talking about one particular person or one particular industry, but, and to be honest, compared to the Panama Papers, we're not talking about maybe a slightly shady organisation. This is mainstream, magic circle, blue chip organisation right at the heart of things. And it is hard to get across just how fed up the public are with stories like this. Just finding out that it's not about freak behaviour, but about an industry essentially dedicated to avoiding vast amounts of taxation. They can't do it in their lives. They pay tax at the source of their income, so they cannot understand why this can be allowed to go on. And I think they're right to have that frustration.
And do you agree with Jeremy Corbyn that some of those people who are exposed for this kind of behaviour should apologise, should be sorry for it? The Lewis Hamiltons, or the, you know, the Queen, be it, or you know, Lord Ashcroft, or, you know, those people who are involved in these kinds of practices?
Well, everyone has to recognise if they have played a role in something like this. Now, I don't believe the Queen personally oversees her investments. I imagine Lewis Hamilton doesn't personally oversee his either. So really it comes down to, you know, why is there professional advice that they're receiving? Why is there an industry devoted to this kind of practice? Now, I think everyone would recognise if you're facing a transaction and, you know, there's two ways to go about it, and one has a sort of higher tax implication. You know, for instance, if you're buying and selling a company or something like that, that's entirely reasonable to weigh that into your calculations as to how you're going to go about doing that. That is different to, you know, for instance, what we see in the Paradise Papers, which is, for instance, people sending their income from legitimate work to an offshore trust, having that income loaned back to them to avoid taxation. Now, clearly that is not right. Whether it's, you know, buying, I think in the Lewis Hamilton case, a private jet, leasing it to yourself. You know, this is not a legitimate way to go about it. It might be legal for now, I think it's dubious in some of the cases, but it might be legal. But if you know you have been involved in that, then yes, you should apologise. It may be you had bad advice, but you've got to recognise that, and then we've got to find a way to change not just the rules, but the culture of an industry that is devoted to this kind of thing.
Jonathan Reynolds there. Well, you can read all our reporting on the Paradise Papers, including such delights as how Bono used a Maltese company to buy a Lithuanian shopping centre, all that and much more at theguardian.com/paradisepapers. Now, as we record this on Wednesday morning, International Development Secretary Priti Patel is in mid-air, having been summoned back from Africa to explain why she conducted a series of unauthorised meetings with Israeli government figures, including Benjamin Netanyahu, while on a family holiday in the summer. Yesterday, the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson faced a barrage of criticism in the Commons over comments he made about the case of a British woman detained in Iran that may have harmed her defence. I'm joined on the line now by Mark Wallace of Conservative Home. Mark, as we speak on Wednesday morning, we think the International Development Secretary is somewhere in midair, don't we? But she seems unlikely to be the International Development Secretary for very long.
Indeed, it's a peculiar kind of limbo in which Priti Patel finds herself flying somewhere across North Africa, I think, as we speak, as you say, with the full expectation that she will be for the high jump when she gets home.
And can you explain how she's ended up in this situation? She seems to have had a rather odd holiday, doesn't she? She seems to have spent more time than one normally does on a family holiday, meeting foreign politicians.
Yes, perhaps I go on the wrong kind of holidays, but it certainly seems that Priti Patel's family holiday in Israel involved a series of meetings with senior figures from the Israeli government, which for her first error didn't get cleared beforehand with the Foreign Office or with Downing Street. For her second error, seemed to have been in the presence also of a lobbyist at the same time. And then following that, there's been a series unravelled over the last few days of revelations of which meetings weren't declared, and then perhaps at best, shall we say, a slowness in accepting that that had happened in the first place. And I think Downing Street have now reached the point where, as well as being frustrated and annoyed at these breaches of the ministerial code in the first place, they are concerned that perhaps there could be other revelations to come out if somebody's not been completely open with them in the first place.
Yes, and much of this seems to have emerged in the media, hasn't it, rather than Priti Patel revealing it herself to the Prime Minister, despite the pair of them having a face-to-face meeting. Were you surprised that Theresa May didn't give her marching orders in the first place?
I wasn't entirely surprised. I mean, it's pretty uncontroversial to say that this Prime Minister has compromised authority since the general election when she fell short and lost her majority. I think we've already seen that in terms of a weakened Downing Street on several different fronts over the last few months. So for obvious reasons, particularly after losing Michael Fallon as Defence Secretary last week, it's kind of easy to imagine why Downing Street will be reluctant to start putting the stick about and sacking other cabinet ministers if they could at all avoid it. Obviously, I think there's been an attempt to perhaps avoid this in the first instance, but it's just got worse and worse.
And Patel is not the only one we've been talking about this week, is she? Boris Johnson has also had a bit of a difficult week.
Indeed, and I do wonder whether Boris Johnson might have had a more difficult week had Priti Patel not been in such trouble over these meetings. So, to a certain extent, some attention in the media has been distracted from Boris Johnson's error, in which, before a parliamentary committee, he made the grievous error of getting his facts completely wrong in terms of this Iranian case and handing what appears to be an excuse to the Iranian government and the Iranian judiciary to potentially further imprison an already long-suffering British citizen.
Yeah, and it's an extraordinary case, and he got a very, very rough ride in the Commons yesterday. I mean, it does play into a particular picture of Johnson, doesn't it, as you know, gaffe-prone. Gaffe is not a serious enough phrase in this case, but as perhaps not taking his job terribly seriously, perhaps not being as well briefed as he ought.
Well, it's always been the peculiar kind of duality of Boris Johnson that it's undeniable that he has a unique media cut-through, that he has a unique appeal among the electorate, as we saw in the course of the EU referendum campaign, that he, as you could say, reaches parts of the electorate that other Conservatives cannot reach. But at the same time, there are serious concerns about perhaps his work ethic, according to some people who've worked closely with him, but also his mastery of detail and the question of quite how responsible he is in serious jobs. And, you've got to consider, of course, that perhaps that was one reason why Theresa May might have thought it wise to put him in a serious job like Foreign Secretary in the first place, which is that if you want perhaps to neuter someone like Boris Johnson as a potential leadership candidate, then give them some responsibility and see whether they can carry the ball or drop it.
Yes, there was a lot of chat about that at the time when he was appointed, wasn't there? Was he being set up to fail, as it were? Will she have to lose more cabinet ministers before this is over, do you think? There's Johnson. There are also these allegations about Damien Green that are being looked at. It doesn't feel very secure, does it, the makeup of the cabinet as it stands?
It doesn't feel very secure. And of course, as the Labour Party would probably justifiably put it, it doesn't feel particularly strong or stable either. So there is a huge difficulty on several different fronts for this government. And particularly when you've got this sense of blood in the water and the shark starting to circle, sometimes scandal can compound on scandal and error can compound on error. And perhaps the more pressure people end up under, the more things they maybe get wrong and the poorer decisions they make. So there is always that potential. If the last week teaches us anything, though, it's that we simply do not know what is coming down the line next. There is the rumbling sexual harassment scandal at the same time. There are various references, including by the Prime Minister earlier this week, that perhaps there are further allegations yet to be made public. We just don't know what nasties might be lurking under further stones that are yet to be lifted.
And should Theresa May have tried to sort of get out ahead of this, some of this stuff, do you think? Should she have had, you know, a clear out? Should she have taken a more robust approach earlier, do you think, when some of these allegations started to emerge?
I think she's actually, in fairness, on the sexual harassment allegations, I think she's done a pretty good job of getting out ahead of this. She hasn't held back in terms of having proper investigations, in terms of being pretty open, in terms of what's gone on. And I think that's for two reasons. Firstly, no one in Westminster has forgotten the expenses scandal, in which all of the institutions involved desperately tried to avoid even having to face the issue, never mind deal with this. And they remember that made things an awful lot worse and actually produced a solution that a lot of people in Westminster still rather dislike, in the form of a quango that runs expenses. Mm. So I think she understands the practicalities. Also, this is something that as a very successful woman, as a woman in politics in particular, at the time which she was coming up in her career, I'm sure that she has a very, very good understanding of quite how difficult an environment it can be for many women. And for that reason, she does want to see justice done. So I think she's done a fairly good job on that front. Could she have done a huge clear-out reshuffle at the start? She could have done, but it would have probably been a mistake, because nobody quite knows exactly what allegations are going to come forward. The last thing you'd want to do would be do a huge reshuffle, potentially half based on suspicion and guesswork, only to find out later on you might end up having to move other ministers anyway. So having to reshuffle your own shuffle would be a disaster.
Sort of rolling reshuffle, yeah. And she's obviously trying to face all of these challenges at the same time as we've got Brexit negotiations, we've got the EU withdrawal bill coming back to the House of the Commons next week, which is, we know, mean feat. Does she look as if she's going to survive in the medium term, do you think? And if not, Conservative Home asks Tory activists, doesn't it, or Tory members, what they think about potential future leadership candidates. Is there anyone else seriously waiting in the wings who could command the support of the party?
Well, to take your questions in order, the question of quite how long Theresa May will last, a lot of these calculations are fundamentally the same as they were back in June, immediately after the general election, when a lot of people might have expected the Prime Minister to go. A lot of very, very few party leaders or Prime Ministers have survived a blow like an election result like that. But the calculation was that in the end, firstly, she had some good people around her who managed to steady the ship and take over from her previous very, very troubled advisory team. But also there was a calculation that, frankly, who is going to step in? And in the middle of a Brexit negotiation, do you want a 2, potentially 3-month leadership election? It would have to be a contested race for the next Conservative leader after May was the beneficiary of what was effectively a coronation the year before. Nobody wants to have that hiatus in the middle of the talks. And also nobody wants to run the risk of another general election, particularly in the parliamentary party. Obviously, most Conservative MPs and ministers had just come through a campaign in which they told the nation, when you have a new prime minister, it's really important you have an election to give them a mandate. Well, I don't think there are many who want to risk another election now rather than in 2022. Those calculations haven't really fundamentally changed. It was always clear that after she survived, she would still be very severely weakened. What we're seeing now is the symptoms of that weakness to a certain extent. Among our among our party member readers of Conservative Home in our monthly survey, we do see a strong majority for the idea that Theresa May should leave before the 2022 election. I don't think there's any real appetite, despite the talk only a couple of months ago, remarkably, it now seems the talk of her perhaps fighting the next general election. I don't think that's going to happen. But also, when we ask people, who do you want to be the next leader, the winner tends to be none of the above. And actually, the candidate who's going to come forward, as is so often the case in Tory leadership elections, is yet really to be in the public eye, I suspect.
That was Mark Wallace of Conservative Home. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Mark Wallace, Jonathan Reynolds, Philip Inman, Nicholas Shackson, Hilary Osborne and Juliet Garside. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.